If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today on Truth in Movies, do you want to build a sequel? Disney does. It's Frozen 2.
I'm going with you.
Anna? No.
Excuse me, I climbed the North Mountain, survived a frozen heart, and saved you from my ex-boyfriend, so, you know, I'm coming.
Then it's the hand-drawn French animation I Lost My Body.
Une fois que t'as dribblé le destin, tu fais quoi?
And in Film Club, it's Ken Russell's rock operatic head trip, Tommy. All coming up in Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair, sitting across this week from Camberley Campbell.
Hello.
Welcome back, Cam. And Caitlin Quinlan.
Hello.
How are you both doing this morning?
Very good, thank you.
I'd never realised how alliterative, like, all of our names
sound. It should go quite nicely.
Yeah, exactly. We're already off to such a great start, and we should keep this momentum going with some Disney magic. Up first this week is Frozen 2. This follow-up to the Oscar-winning box office smash answers the question, why was Elsa born with magical powers? The answer is calling her and threatening her kingdom, and together with Anna, Kristoff, Olaf and Sven, she sets out on a dangerous but remarkable journey.
The kingdom is not safe. Find who is calling to you. They may have answers.
I'm going with you.
Anna? No.
Excuse me, I climbed the North Mountain, survived a frozen heart, and saved you from my ex-boyfriend, so, you know, I'm coming.
Frozen 2 there. So, Caitlin, this is coming a good 5 or 6 years after the first Frozen broke box office records for animation at the box office, etc. Are we excited for a sequel?
I mean, I think with Disney sequels these days, it's always a bit of a kind of, you know, they're just pumping out the corporate clockwork machine again. But I think the first Frozen film had a lot going for it. It was obviously a mass hit. The songs, you know, have been stuck in people's heads for the duration of, you know, this gap between the films. So I was quite excited to see where this film was going to go. And I thought the trailer actually had sort of put together quite a promising view of the film. So, yeah, I was quite excited, I will say.
What was that promise then in the trailer? Did the film bear it out?
I think the thing about this film is that there's actually just quite a lot of grandeur to it. And there's quite a lot of musical sequences that there's I don't know if they're ever going to match up to Let It Go, which obviously, you know, kind of took the world by storm, but there are some big musical numbers in this, and I think the trailer really did a good job of kind of capturing that, the kind of power of those. So there's a lot of visual grandeur and just like excess that's, I think, done quite nicely in the film. Like, a lot of the animation is really nice around those scenes. So yeah, the trailer I think promised a lot of that kind of beauty and like this very sparkly film. I think
one thing that you can definitely say about this film is that it shows off animation standards as high as they are today. Mm-hmm. You realise even between this and the previous film that it's gone on leaps and bounds. And they really do try to find another Let It Go style banger, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, I think there's two,
like twice, yeah.
two that they try and, yeah.
I was going to say that it's like they're trying to balance out the fact that the first Frozen forgot it was a musical mm-hmm. after, I think, maybe after Let It Go, they just kind yep. of stopped trying to top. It was like the film, they realised that like there's not really any topping it, so let's just kind of like tail off from here. And then here, it's just they're trying to match it with this quantity of tracks that consistently, yeah. not one but two Elsa self-actualization anthems
yeah.
and things like these musical pastiches from Jonathan Groff, which mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, but I thought sort of brought the movie to a grinding standstill.
So like, if we're talking about the same number, the way it's directed is almost like an 80s, 90s
yes.
power ballad, music video pastiche, which almost for me, I thought the first film did really well was that it was its own thing. It wasn't. It was sort of parodying, but also very much played as a fantasy fairy tale adventure. That's the scene like, there, which felt like it was from Shrek.
I was literally just about to say that. I thought it was very funny in the moment, but it felt really strange and a little more cynical. Which is maybe not the vibe you want from a film with the number 2 in the title. Mm-hmm. It just made it feel like they were saying, oh, we know what audiences want. And things like the Olaf recaps of the first film and sort of the sly winking at things like that started to grate on me a little bit.
It feels like there's like an inevitability to all of those kind of moments in these sequels now, because I think, you know, they knew that there was a certain checklist, I think, that they had to tick with this film, considering how successful the first one was. And, you know, there's expectations that people have. So I kind of see it as like those two forces battling against each other. Like, we need to make a film that everyone's going to love, but we also need to acknowledge that there is probably some things we can poke fun at, or that we should try and, you know, make a bit sort of more tongue-in-cheek. I don't know, to me it seemed like they were kind of battling those two angles,
sort of like proving that they're like self-aware of and I suppose, like you were saying with the Jonathan Groff song, as fun as it is, maybe it could have been done with being a little bit more just straightforwardly earnest, which is a strange thing to say about a Disney movie. I was very interested in the sort of narrative's tack about how it was Elsa versus colonialism, which was a really... I thought it was kind of refreshing in its sort of matching the subversions of traditional fantasy tales of the first. So like in the first film, there's like a handsome prince who whisks Kristen Bell's Anna away. And it turns out that he's awful. And similarly in this, there are some things about their kingdom's history that aren't so sparkly, but it sort of, I feel like it ultimately backs down from any real consequences, which is kind of a problem with the first, considering that it's, rather than critiquing the sort of Disney's traditional system of Princess Mary's beautiful prince, it sort of just gives them an easy sort of individualized target. And I feel like it creates a very similar problem here and sort of goes through with the expected everything worked out power of love.
It is interesting, isn't it? So they bring in the two massive themes into this film. One is a sort of Greta Thunberg era environmental message about this mysterious magical forest.
Very Mononoke.
Exactly. Very Studio Ghibli, really, although Disney have always had problems trying to capture that spirit in their films, haven't they? But then also the sense of post-colonial, the history of imperialism, looking back through the generations of the kingdom and their relationship with the land, as well as this story of Elsa trying to find the true source of her powers. And it does pull its punches, I think, whilst bringing up some really fascinating themes. There's a great article that went up online this week by So Mayer, the critic.
Going to quote this as well. It's
on the
great.
Sight and Sound website, which really pulls those themes apart and looks at them through the lens of what it's trying to tell kids now and trying to undo the thinking of these fairy tales for generations. I don't think the film goes as far as it could with them.
Yeah, it sort of just eases off the throttle at maybe the most crucial moment, I think, where there's sort of all of this symbolism that it's been like building up. It's kind of like this whoa cowboy sort of thing and just completely like backs down.
I think it's always the case with like, you know, mega corporate Disney approach to a film that there's going to always have to be a limit to what they can actually, like the message they can actually send. And as much as not, you know, there's one sort of moment towards the end where you think like, wow, this film's actually really going to do something quite big here.
It's radical.
But it inevitably doesn't. But I do think that I was reading in the article that Michael just mentioned, there's some really interesting things about how in this film, you know, it seems that they actually tried to correct some of the mistakes that they made within the first one in terms of like culturally appropriating traditions of like the Sami region in like the Nordic countries. So I think they've taken a similar approach to what they did with the film Moana and tried to incorporate the kind of traditions and teachings and the knowledge of the people that they're actually telling the story about into the, you know, the making of the film. So it's interesting that that's come into this one as well, that they're trying to maybe make this actually have more of a political core. But yeah, obviously it kind of gets swamped by the Disney machine, unfortunately.
It does feel like a very reactive movie. Like the last notes feel like someone made a note somewhere in production, just being like, I don't know about this. And then the rest seems like they are trying to correct a lot. Not that that's inherently a problem, but it feels very self-conscious in that way. This is a completely unrelated tangent, but whenever someone invoked the different elemental spirits, my mind instantly just went to Avatar: The Last Airbender. Just like the intro with the fire, earth, water.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a funny thing for them to do. They just give Elsa more powers throughout this film.
Yeah, but it leads to some of the prettiest stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think some of it's gorgeous.
I'm not particularly fond of the sort of plasticky textures of all the characters, but I think when the film sort of pulls back and when it's like observing the landscapes they've created, it looks amazing. And or when it goes more into the abstract, like Elsa reaches a certain magical location and the way her powers sort of interact with this world is amazing. Just this black background and all of these very intricate patterns which feel like they're recalling sort of old Disney animation.
Yeah, I thought a lot about like Fantasia and things that. We were kind of, that some of that stuff's really, really beautiful, and it's just refreshing to see and takes you out of, as you say, that like plasticky world of the kind of, all these characters are so made to be made into dolls, you know, that's like the whole kind of the visuals of them. But all the landscapes and the scenery and the forest and the sort of, as I say, like the sparkle of it is, I think, done really, really nicely.
So yeah, visually stunning, but what scores would you give this, Caitlin? So in anticipation, enjoyment in retrospect?
I think, as I say, I was, you know, moderately excited, I'd say, for this. I think maybe a 3 in anticipation. I kind of had the expectation that this probably wasn't going to blow my mind or change the world, but yeah, I was quite excited to see it. So maybe a 3 for anticipation. I enjoyed watching this film. I would give it a 4. Admittedly, I'm probably a bit of a sucker for like a key change and a very cute little Pokemon type creature that joins, you know, Elsa's side. The fire spirit is really adorable. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but I think there was a lot to it that I enjoyed. The parts of the animation, the story kind of taking a different turn. So yeah, I'd say a 4. And then in retrospect, as we've said, like a lot of the kind of path that it could go down, it doesn't necessarily go that far. So maybe I'd be thinking, looking back on it, wishing that it had actually taken those extra steps. Maybe a 3. Yeah, looking back now.
Okay. Campbelly.
I think I trend a bit lower because I wasn't a huge Frozen enthusiast in the first place. I sort of forgot this was happening. I forgot the film was coming out until very sort of close to actually watching it. I think I'd probably go with a 2 in anticipation because I think it's one of the lower Disney efforts, as good as, well, as catchy as some of the songs were. Again, in terms of actual enjoyment, I'd say a 3. A lot of the craft was very solid, even though I didn't love all of it. And I sort of similarly had a problem with its sort of non-committal nature to its themes and this sort of strange, cynical undercurrent that was kind of just underneath it. And also, I just despise everything with Olaf the Snowman. I'm sorry.
It doesn't work for you at all.
No, I hate him. I only wish ill on animated Josh Gad.
There we go.
In retrospect, a 2. For the same reasons, but I think my opinion on that sort of holds.
I'd say 3s across the board for me. Parents up and down the country are going to be subjected to this film over and over again, and I'm sure it's perfectly watchable and fine. Yeah. It could have gone a bit further. There's some of that wisdom missing that you'd find in something like Studio Ghibli, or even Pixar, or even other Disney films. You mentioned Moana. That was built from the ground up as a celebration of Polynesian culture,
and what they
have here is a bit of a hedge. So perhaps not the quality that you'd want, but it's going to be Disney's $6 billion grossing film this year, probably.
It's going to be huge.
It's going to deliver money on the corporate side.
Yes.
It's going to print money, and I'm probably going to listen to the Jonathan Groff song again, as much as I was critiquing it here.
Future karaoke song, maybe. Yeah.
I think so. I'm such a mark for something like this, and I hate it.
Anyway, that was Frozen 2. Up next, we're sticking with animation for I Lost My Body. In a Parisian laboratory, a severed hand escapes its unhappy fate and sets out to reconnect with its body. During a hair-raising escapade across the city, the hand fends off pigeons and rats alike to reunite with pizza boy Naufel. Its memories of Naufel and his love for librarian Gabrielle may provide answers about what caused the hand's separation and a poetic backdrop for a possible reunion between the three.
Une fois que t'as dribblé le destin, tu fais quoi?
So this is a French language film. Let's dive straight in. Cam, can you give a bit of background for this film?
So it's based on, I think, a short story by the screenwriter who was also the screenwriter of Amelie, whose name I can't remember right now, directed by Jeremy Clapin. We've already made a bunch of one-hand Clapin jokes, so we'll just leave that. But yeah, it sort of takes on this sort of quasi-romantic tone in how it's sort of uses its visual language to portray this longing between the hand and its former partner, I suppose. And it sort of creates these parallel narratives with the flashback and the Hand's progression back to Naufel and Naufel's sort of tentative romance with Gabrielle. It's got a problematic element, I think.
A very European element, I'd probably say.
Yeah.
Could you explain what that is, maybe?
Well, he delivers a pizza to Gabrielle and falls in love with her via intercom. And one of those kind of situations where he just walks off and he just like doesn't get her number or anything, attempts to call her in the yellow pages and his actions are interrupted. And it basically, it's all of these almost farcical circumstances that eventually leads him into pretending he's someone else and following her home to her uncle's workshop, where he then gets a job and continues to be silent about the nature of how they've actually met before. He's sort of presented in this very harmless way. And like you said, it sort of feels very European. So it sort of dulls the insidiousness of it, but it's still weird.
To have that as your sort of meet cute and your great lie behind a romance.
Yeah. It's not like it never addresses it, so it sort of saves itself from being poisonous in that element, but it would feel amiss not to mention it.
To mention that up top, because I know that some people have really found it hard to connect with this film because of that aspect. Whereas really, I'd say that's one of the two flashback levels. The main narrative strand of this film is the hand. And anyone who's seen a poster or a promotional still from this film will see that it is almost like the thing from the Addams Family.
Just the way it moves
wandering around. Or maybe the hand from Evil Dead. It's going into the canon of great hand movies. Caitlin, would you agree?
Yes, I think the two kind of split narratives work really interestingly. And some of the stuff that actually goes on with the hand, I think, is quite terrifying at times. There's sort of the hand's journey to sort of be reunited with its former body. It kind of takes the hand on this journey through the underground levels of Paris and into the kind of the suburbs. And it's one of my favourite things about the film, actually, is how they map out Paris. It's a film where you don't see an Eiffel Tower, you don't see the Arc de Triomphe, you see no visual landmarks of the city, apart from maybe like the subway station or metro stations, which are quite well known. But this hand kind of navigates through the city on a very sort of low ground level. And now Fell is sort of navigating the city on this higher, you know, roof level almost in lots of scenes. And it just creates this really beautiful narrative of like a background Paris, a sort of hidden Paris that's never really allowed to be expressed, which is really interesting considering that the writer also worked on Amelie, which is, you know,
it's a very like basically Eiffel Tower.
Exactly, which is basically like, you know,
chocolate box
written
Paris,
written the textbook on how to make films about Paris. But the hand story, it's really terrifying at times. It manages to be very, very poignant in certain scenes. There's one moment where it kind of, again, sounds really creepy, but it kind of looks down on a baby and like comes up to the cot. And again, that sounds very, very odd, but it's a very nice scene about connection. And I think trying to re-engage with like a world around you.
Yeah, and sequences like, it's like a survival thriller.
Yes, with the rats in the
cracks in the tracks of the subway where there's
rats sort of nibbling at the fingers. Yeah. It's creepy.
And likewise, quite horrifying sequences with pigeons in the air.
Yes. Right and towards the beginning,
This film premiered at Cannes in Critics Week. It won the top prize there. It also did really well at Annecy, which is the big animation festival. And you can see that this is really pioneering animation here, a real announcement of a new talent. Of course, Jeremy Clapin had made shorts beforehand. This is his first feature. It's fascinating to go from Frozen 2, which is the cutting edge of what all of the server farms in California can make, whereas this is the small European art house animation that's just as good.
Yeah, it's got a texture to it that I was sort of craving from things like Frozen 2, just the sketchiness of all the environments. The sequences of the hand are just so, like, some of them are just so beautiful. Like things like maybe taking a quick rest in someone's house just to listen to someone play the piano. The way the hand is sort of just barely anthropomorphized is really kind of incredible, short of just this finding very creative ways to sort of visually express any kind of, I suppose, if hands feel melancholy, any melancholy that it actually is feeling, just this really sort of impeccable visual language and just these beautiful colours as well.
And also kind of opposite to that, I think the scenes that are in black and white are just as stunning. The kind of flashbacks to Naufel's just so childhood in Morocco, which kind of forms part of the backstory. Some of those feel so textured and so moving. And, you know, there's just moments where you're watching a hand kind of sink into grains of sand. And it's like a feeling that is so, you know, universal and so known. But this animation just really captures that kind of softness and that texture. And the light and the family, that sort of their interactions when they're just driving in a car and like he's making field recordings like out the window. It's lovely.
It's a very appropriately tactile film. Just that sort of attention to details about the wind blowing through a microphone.
Yeah. Just like the way his mother like holds a mirror in like her own hand and things like that, I think are really beautiful touches.
I suppose
yeah, it has to be, because it's about a hand, exactly. Therefore it has to be tactile. It's a really fascinating film. Kimberly, what scores would you give I Lost My Body?
I'll go with 3. I wasn't really not familiar with any of Clapham's work, and Amelie's fine, I guess. but in terms of enjoyment, 4, I thought it was really, really surprisingly beautiful, very weird and grotesque, just walking a very fine line between those things, just really creative, moving stuff. And I think I'll hold out at 4. Mm-hmm. I genuinely think it's one of the year's best animated films.
Brilliant. Caitlin?
Yeah, I think I would go 3 as well for anticipation. Again, I wasn't too familiar with Clapham's work. And I guess the premise, you know, when you hear that it's kind of about a severed hand exploring a city, you're like, sure, why not? So, yeah, so it was 3 for anticipation. 4 for enjoyment. I really did enjoy the film. As I've said, like, the animation is really beautiful. There's a poignancy to a lot of the narrative. The thing, as I said, the thing that really drew me in was the way it navigates this city space and really kind of allows for a sort of a background story to come to the foreground and to tell an immigrant story, essentially, in a city that doesn't have to be all glitz and glamour. But I think in retrospect, I would go a little bit lower. I think 3, that relationship story did really drag it down for me. I found it quite hard to engage with that because it did seem like a very unnecessary conceit and just could have been done so differently. So that I struggled to forget, that this quite stalkerish approach to relationship narrative. And also it's, you know, Gabrielle, as much as there is a kind of reckoning with it at some point, she never really gets past a kind of like manic pixie dream girl stage, which I think is unfortunate for a female character.
The hand gets more agency.
The hand has more agency. But I did enjoy the film.
Yeah, so I'd say 4s across the board for this one. I was very excited to see it at Cannes. Whenever I go to film festivals, I always look out for animations, and just seeing that still and reading the one-liner about a hand fighting its way through Paris to be reunited with its owner. Mm. And it delivers on that level completely, even if there are some flaws in there. Yeah. But I do particularly like how it does strain with some ambition to make a poetic statement out of all of these flashbacks and flash-forwards and the hand and the body and the people in his life. It does try to find something. If it doesn't really find it at the end, it's still quite an emotional journey along the way. And probably 4 in retrospect, just because I want to see something more from Jeremy Clapham. Mm,
yeah.
Maybe he can make Kung Fu Panda 4, maybe?
Who knows? Frozen 3.
Anyway, that's I Lost My Body, which is in cinemas this weekend and on Netflix from next weekend, I believe.
The 29th, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So you should be able to see that in some form over the next 2 weeks. And that wraps up the animation segment of this episode. Frozen 2, I Lost My Body, both in cinemas. Let us know what you think at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lblies.com/podcast. What's next? Or should I say, who's next? It's Tommy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Back in cinemas, thanks to the BFI and their recent musical season, is this entirely unique take on rock opera from director Ken Russell. Adapted from the landmark album by The Who, Tommy follows the story of a deaf, dumb and blind boy who becomes a pinball prodigy and eventually leads his own religion. Who frontman Roger Daltrey stars in the title role, with key cameos from the likes of Jack Nicholson, Tina Turner, Eric Clapton and Elton John. Campbell, was this a first watch for you?
It was a first watch for me. It was my first Ken Russell, so I'm off to...
Oh, wow, deep end, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, in short, I'm off to a horrible start with him. I feel like I very much caught on to how I was feeling about it in the first half hour. I stuck out as long as I possibly could. Just I was just like, maybe there'll be a number that I enjoy. I suppose I liked Pinball Wizard. That was fun with Elton John in sort of 7 foot boots, but oh man, wait, somehow they've made a rock opera where in which, while being populated by a lot of musical idols, it seems like no one can sing. Everything just seems so poorly orchestrated, and a lot of the time I was just thinking about how much I'd rather be watching Phantom of the Paradise.
Yes.
Which this somehow feels trashier, but seemingly by accident. I appreciated the sort of psychedelic visuals. They were kind of interesting, but it just this sort of constant, like, nails on a chalkboard sound of Oliver Reed trying to string together a musical number. I wanted to go deaf and dumb and blind as well.
That's your poster quote from 1975 right there.
I mean, I'm sure someone has said it.
Yeah, maybe not the first. It is funny, isn't it? This is a musical where the entire film is sung. I think there's one line of dialogue in the whole thing. So you have to sit there and watch Oliver Reed, who can't sing.
He's a musical legend. He was Fagin, let's not...
But he didn't have a song, in Oliver.
True.
So, tricky there. We do have some comments from Twitter. For Tommy, we asked, does this rock opera hold up? Dirty Disco Sound System said, utter cobblers people, always was. Uncle Monty said, lol, no, it's awful. Fiddle about, shudder. Brett Cole says, seems I'm in the minority here, but I think it is fantastic. Startling images... sequences that marries with the music incredibly well. Tina Turner and Elton John providing iconic cameos too. Caitlin, a little bird tells me you might agree with Brett to a certain extent.
To a certain extent, I do agree that Fiddle About is a horrendous element to this film, and it is incredibly disturbing and horrible. And Keith Moon, I feel like he takes far too much like enjoyment in playing that horrible uncle role. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where he cracks an egg into a pint of Newcastle brown ale, and it made me want to throw up. But no, I think this is a really bonkers film, but there is something so trashy and just amazing about the visuals and the kind of the whole opera of it that I think is really fun. And I was totally engaged throughout. I was vaguely familiar with the music. I think the first kind of recording of the album is slightly different to the film that Ken Russell then kind of wrote. And so I was slightly familiar with the music, and obviously Pinball Wizard is a classic song, and I love The Who. So I was very excited. This was the first time I'd watched it, but I was really excited to see it, and was just completely, you know, like taken aback by some of the scene constructions and the costumes and the lights and the sort of the landscapes, and Roger Daltrey like climbing up these like mountainsides and dancing in waterfalls, and it's totally, totally mad. But there is something really fun and great about it, I think. And it's totally surreal and just bonkers. But I think there's something just worthwhile in that. You know, it's just fun.
I think from the production design standpoint, and this is why it's great to see this in the context of the BFI musical season, to see this out of context, I would only bring to this film my love of the original album.
Right,
and let's go into Dad Rock Corner for a second. I was into Dad Rock before I was a dad. I think that this is an absolutely terrible version of that album.
Right,
I think
that...
And it's not all Ken Russell's fault. He had no interest in rock music. He only wanted to see it as this outsized opera. Mm. Pete Townshend, the major creative force behind The Who, was a very different musician in 1975 than he was in 1969, the main thing being he discovered synthesizers. So the music in the film sounds atrocious, whereas the impetus behind Tommy, the album in 1969, was they wanted to keep it contained in terms of the arrangements, so it could be something they could play live. So it's only that key bass drums guitar with a bit of French horn, a bit of keyboards, acoustics every now and then. And that 69 album sounds incredible now, and it doesn't work as a concept album.
No.
The story doesn't work. There are songs that are there as jokes.
It's kind of a bizarre concept in the first, right, anyway. So, yeah, the fact that it then... I feel like the film, like Ken Russell's film, kind of takes that and blows it out of proportion in so many ways. And, yeah, obviously the production design completely complements that and makes it this really grand and totally wild film. But I think there's something in the kind of colours and textures that it feels like such an artefact of that time. And I think that's something that I find quite fascinating about it, is seeing how so many different things had influenced that and have since been influenced by all that imagery and the look of the time, that there's something really kind of, it's like a time capsule, I think. It's really fascinating.
And the other tough thing is you have one of the great rock and roll vocalists of all time, Roger Daltrey, who is he's a vision in this film. He's topless.
He was ripped
at all times.
He is so ripped.
But you have one of the great rock vocalists who doesn't sing for an hour and 5 minutes at all, because he's the deaf, dumb and blind boy.
Yeah.
The great thing about Tommy, the album, is that he does nearly all of the singing voices.
Yeah, it's true. And I think, you do kind of build up to that point at the end, and then I suppose it ties in with the progression to him becoming this cult figure and this cult leader, which is, I think, where the film does lose it, to be honest. Everything before that, I think, is much more interesting than him kind of, raising to this cult status. But I think maybe it does have some interesting things to say about the cult of celebrity and, the rise of hysteria amongst fans and those kinds of, musical fan clubs and scenes and things like that. Like, there's a lot of interesting stuff to draw out there. But yeah, I think, it does build up to Roger Daltrey having this big kind of finale moment where he gets to be the voice of the film again. But I think some of the cameos before he gets to, kind of take center stage are really amazing. Like, Tina Turner is fantastic.
She's scary, isn't she?
She's scary, but it's a great sequence. I think it's really wild. And even Anne Margaret, who plays his mother.
Only 2 years older than Roger Daltrey.
She's wild in this film. Her eyes are completely, totally bonkers.
And if it reveals anything about how the Hollywood industry has changed, that was an Oscar-nominated performance.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
She throws herself into it. And of course,
there's
that central sequence where she has her nervous breakdown in front of the telly.
Yeah.
And she's bathing in, I guess is it Nutella?
It's
and beans.
Baked beans and...
all sorts.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very committed performance. She is one of the better singers, or the reader less so. What do you think of the other cameos?
I like Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
I think it's fun. His singing voice is not too bad, but it feels like he's sort of more speaking some of the lines rather than singing. And obviously the Elton John moment is, probably the kind of like the pinnacle of that film. His version of Pinball Wizard is not my favourite, but I think that is, again, kind of like an artifact of him in that time, in that moment. The costume, the makeup, the glasses, everything about that feels so glitzy and just kind of like stunning to watch. So yeah, I did like Elton John in this.
I think also the tricky thing with most of those cameos is that, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong on this, but I think Elton John's the only cameo where the star is in the ascendant. Eric Clapton was at a tricky phase in his career where he's just kicked his heroin habit and just isn't really doing anything
in
when he does Eyesight to the Blind. And Tina Turner as well is in that sort of hinterland between her 60s hits with Ike and then her 80s Private Dancer comeback. So it's a funny one where you hear about who could have been in this film. Mick Jagger they tried to get. But
Stevie Wonder I read as well.
He wanted to be the Pinball Wizard. David Bowie was meant to be the Acid Queen.
So that would have made perfect sense.
So you could see how if they got everybody they wanted circa 1975, it could have been really a star-studded thing. Mm. As it is, I think only Elton John's Pinball Wizard is the song that could stand separate from this film. And it's such a shame because I think that while The Who would make better concept albums later in their career, the album they'd make directly after Tommy, Who's Next, in terms of their big belter songs, probably their best.
Yeah.
Tommy has some great melodies.
I think so too. I think there's some refrains throughout that are really memorable and, wouldn't feel out of place in one of their bigger anthems or, the songs that they're most remembered for. But clearly Pinball Wizard is the standout from this. And the sequence in the film is, I think, the best. Yeah, I'm kind of obsessed with it now. I think it's just...
Have you seen many other Ken Russell films?
I've not. I was trying to remember, go back through and see which ones I thought I'd seen.
He's always been a sort of blind spot for me. I've kept The Devils as a rainy day film.
Right.
I will watch it someday. The only other film of his I've seen is Listomania, which I think he makes almost directly after this with Roger Daltrey as Franz Liszt.
Okay, maybe I'll add that to...
Which is crazier. There's a sequence where Roger Daltrey is riding a, I think it's like 9-foot prosthetic penis.
Great, it's on the list.
That's on your list. Anyway, that is Tommy, which has been re-released as part of the BFI musical season. A really great season. Check it out. They're doing the whole span of musicals. It's been a real treat seeing what they've been covering. And that's about all we have time for this week. Let us know what you think about Tommy, I Lost My Body, or Frozen 2 at the usual channels. Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comment section at lwis.com/podcast. Next week we have a bumper episode, three new releases, Knives Out, Atlantics, The Nightingale, and in Film Club, this Stanley Kubrick masterpiece, Eyes Wide Shut. I'd hear nothing to the contrary about that, but I won't be here. I'll be in Tokyo, so I'll leave you in the capable hands of Beth Webb. Caitlin, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Thanks so much.
Camberley unfortunately had to dash out a little early, but thank you to Camberley. I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.